It's Thursday, June 30th. Welcome to Market Foolery. I'm Chris Hill. Joining me in studio today from Motley Fool Deep Value, Ron Gross, and from Motley Fool Funds, Bill Barker. Gentlemen.
Hey.
Thanks for being here.
Our pleasure.
Let me just put listeners on notice for a couple of things. This is the last episode of the first half of 2016. The market is closed on Monday, July 4th, because it is the Independence Day holiday, so we will not be here. We'll be back on Tuesday.
With a vengeance.
We'll be back with a vengeance. And last but not least, because this is the last episode leading into a long weekend, we might go long. We might go a little longer today.
This could be trouble.
Who's around next week? You coming in?
I'm coming in on Tuesday, yeah, okay. When the market is open. Sure, I'll be here.
I'm taking my daughter to college orientation. I'm out.
Yeah. All next week?
Most of next week.
All right. We got a lot to get to. We've got some earnings. We will dip into the full mailbag. The news fairy showed up literally an hour before we started taping, less than an hour before we started taping. We'll get to that. Let's do a quick hit on the bank stress test, though, because that was coming into this morning, Ron. That was the lead story, the stress tests for the major banks, and virtually all of them passed. And as someone who does not study banks very closely, but has had a couple of physical stress tests, whenever this happens, I always think, these things aren't that stressful for the banks.
Right.
They're just not.
It depends on how good the doctor is, right?
Right.
31 out of 33 passed. Morgan Stanley did pass, but it kind of just snuck by. They got a little slap on the wrist there. Deutsche Bank and Santander, which I have no idea how to pronounce, were the two that failed. Which basically is good. It means our banking system is relatively healthy, certainly compared to what it was going into 2008 and the bailouts. They'll now have the permission to buy back stock, increase dividends, should be good for shareholders. So our banks do look healthier. It doesn't mean they're returning great returns on equity, but they are relatively healthy.
Yeah, in all seriousness, you're absolutely right. They are healthier. We got sort of a preview of this earlier in the week when people were looking at U.S. banks in the wake of the Brexit vote and saying, "Well, wait a minute, how are we doing? How well are they?" And resoundingly, what you heard was, our banks are in much better shape to withstand any sort of ripple effect from Brexit than they were in 2008, 2009.
Exactly. It's actually great timing because it kind of eases some of the uncertainty from Brexit, although certainly not all of it. But banks are such a big part of the economy, and they cause such uncertainty in people's minds that it's nice to get a little piece of good information.
Have you ever had a stress test on your heart? Have you ever had one of those?
I've had an EKG, but not a stress test.
Okay. So just for those unfamiliar, a stress test is when you're hooked up to a bunch of things. The doctor puts you on a treadmill and you start walking, and then the doctor speeds it up and increases the incline. And the point of the stress test is to get you to the point where you can no longer run, where it's just to exhaust you. And sort of how does your heart do under those type of conditions?
So
when I see the bank stress test, I go, yeah, they're stressful. They're just not that level of stress.
Are there any mind games played during the stress test by the doctor?
They poke you.
Not by mine.
I see your identity has been stolen, something like that. They threw it.
You know what? That might be another wrinkle to throw in.
It's a stress test.
There's a call from your spouse. She's very angry for some reason.
I'll mention that to my doctor because I'm due for one next year. So
you want to up the...
see if he could throw that in there. As I mentioned, the news fairy showed up just within the past hour. Shares of Hershey up 18% on reports that the company has received a takeover bid from Mondelez International. But here is the kicker. The Hershey Trust owns 8.5% of the stock, and yet it controls 81% of the vote. So first, this is where I turn to Bill Barker and say, can you explain to our listeners what the Hershey Trust is and how it came to own 8.5% of the stock?
Sure. The Hershey Trust is, so when Milton Hershey died, actually when his wife prematurely died, he gave essentially all of his money, which was the money from founding the company, the Hershey Chocolate Company, to the trust for the purpose of running the, I think it was called originally the Hershey School for Orphan Boys, something like that, or the Hershey Industrial School for Orphan Boys. And that school is still around, and because of his bequest of his ownership stake in Hershey, which has largely been held and not diversified terribly much by the trust, they have the controlling stake. They also have, going into today, I've got $8 billion and I've got $11 billion as numbers for the endowment, making it competitive with the largest universities in the world in terms of financial assets in the endowment. It would probably be about the size of Michigan or Columbia. So around 7 or 8, 9, something like that in the list of biggest endowments of universities.
So when you're looking at biggest endowments, it's like Harvard, Stanford, the Hershey Industrial School for Orphan Boys.
Right. It's Harvard, Yale, Texas, Princeton, Stanford, blah, blah, blah. And then you get down to about 10, and then you're at Penn, Michigan, Columbia. And that's somewhere in there, especially after today, or at least if we stop the clock right now while the stock is up 15-16%, it's got that much more money, couple billion dollars more perhaps.
So do we think the trust is interested in selling here?
Any indication? In the past, they haven't.
They have not. Right.
In the past, they have not. They have no need. They have a different set of financial concerns than most shareholders. And that has allowed them to reject offers in the past. This is not the first time that somebody's come around looking to add Hershey to their stable, and everything in the past has been unsuccessful. So we'll see what they think this time around. But there's essentially no financial pressure on them, and as you say, because of their control of the voting class of shares, this is up to them. This is up to the trust.
I could see easily why Mondelez would want them, which, by the way, Mondelez continues to be the worst name public company.
Wait. But you did hear recently the Tribune Publishing changed their name to Trunk.
Yeah, that's not – that's in the running.
That's on the short list.
But Hershey consistently generates gobs of cash flow, and their return on capital 25% or higher consistently, return on equity 40 to 60% depending on what years you're looking at. It's a really nice business. I could totally see why, you know, for the price of, let's call it $25 billion right now, Mondelez would be interested.
But we were talking earlier, Bill, and you mentioned something that makes me question the Mondelez attempt to acquire this company. And Mondelez has built its strength through diversification of the foods that it sells, but also its global footprint. And you were saying that Hershey's chocolate is as popular as it is here in the United States. That's how unpopular it is, apparently, according to you, in the rest of the world.
The Great American Chocolate Bar is named that because it was a catchy tune, I guess, jingle, and also because it's not considered great anywhere else. Europe really has a different taste for chocolate. Of course, Mondelez has got Cadbury, which is the dominant brand there, but Hershey's is made with a different process. And if you ever go back and pick up a copy of The Chocolate Wars, which is a fascinating book about the history of Hershey and Mars and their processes for making chocolate in their development, it's Hershey's chocolate is milk chocolate is made with a souring process, which to Americans tastes right. That tastes like what milk chocolate should be, because that's what we're all grow up with piles of it in Halloween bags. And the rest of the world tastes it and says this is like barnyard chocolate. And then by the rest of the world, actually, I'm referring to Europe. Hershey's has had some success in China, which hadn't had the same, you know, experience and history with chocolates that Europe has had. So it has been promising as being a global opportunity for Hershey in a way that Europe just simply never seems like it will be.
I don't know. I feel like they both work for me. I like Hershey's. I like Cadbury.
Yeah, I like the higher end, higher cocoa content, but I'll take some chocolate chips from Hershey's any day.
Well, those are usually Nestle.
Oh, that's true. They sometimes chips. Are. Yeah.
Yeah. So go try to find Hershey in Europe. You know, you'll find Snickers, Mars, mounds all over the place, but you won't find much.
No Hershey's Kisses anywhere to be found?
I'm not saying none to be found, but they're not popular. They're not like the Mars brands that you know are easy to find, and the Hershey's brands that you know are not.
Let's move on to some earnings. McCormick & Company shares hitting an all-time high. Second quarter profits came in slightly higher than expected. This seemed like a yet another good workman-like quarter for McCormick.
Yep.
Does anything stand out to you in this?
The consumer segment was strong, up 8% for the quarter, helped by an acquisition of Gourmet Garden. Company has been acquiring companies over the years to kind of spur growth, because there's not that much growth, let's face it, in the world of spices. So sometimes an acquisition is necessary. Gross margins widened. Love to see that. They're planning on reducing costs by $400 million over the next 4 years, and they upped the goal for this year to $100 million to $110 million.
How are they doing that?
Right back to the bottom line. First of all, every company can cut costs. It's just, do they have the will to do it? They can streamline processes. They can cut staff where necessary. And there's a lot of fat in companies that most, if they have the will, can take a fair amount of costs out of a business. Their guidance, their adjusted guidance, we should call it, because there are some one-time charges, but their adjusted guidance remains unchanged. And the company continues to do real well. Pays a small dividend, 1.7%, not too shabby. Has a lot of cash, 27 times earnings. I wouldn't call it a cheap stock because, it is at its 52-week high, and it is up 20% this year. But they continue to execute really well.
You had mentioned the consumer segment growth. Is that outpacing what they're doing on the industrial side? I think anyone who's been in a grocery store has probably seen, it's pretty hard to avoid if you're going down the spice aisle, the McCormick display.
They own it.
What you don't realize is that they've got a hole behind the scenes working directly with companies like Yum Brands and others.
Yeah, that continues to grow just at a slower pace, as you said, sub 3% for this latest quarter. So still growing, but consumer, again, largely as a result of acquisitions, is outpacing it.
It's been a hell of a good run and continues, as Ron points out. At this point, part of the impressive stock performance, and it's been up every year since 2009, at least 10% every year. And at this point, you've got to attribute an amount of that, which may be worrying, to multiple expansion rather than just simply growth of the business. And it's a safe company. Packaged foods has been a good place to be, just like restaurants. But the only thing really to say against the stock is that the multiple is challenging. You can't expand your multiple forever. You can keep growing your business at 7-8%, something like that, forever. Throw out a little bit of a dividend, but I would be wary about looking for the stock to hold this level forever.
Well, one stock that might be more of a bargain is Darden Restaurants, the parent company of Longhorn Steakhouse, Capital Grille, and of course, Steve Broido's beloved Olive Garden. Fourth quarter results looked good, although the guidance for the full fiscal year was pretty weak, and that's why I think we're seeing the stock down about 4% today.
Yeah, it was kind of a fine quarter, but as you say, nothing too great. There was an extra week last time, so results look a little screwy. If you exclude that week, sales were up about 2% for the quarter. That's okay. 2.6% was their same-store sales number, led by Capital Grille, up 3.7%, and Seasons 52, which was up 5%. They're doing pretty well. Steve's Olive Garden up 2.4%. So
Steve's
pretty
doing
good.
What he can, people.
Yeah. Profits are up 9%. You can't complain too much here. They increased the dividend by 12%. We're now at a 3.6% yield. So some decent things going on. Guidance for the upcoming year, as you said, not unbelievable. Certainly didn't knock the cover off the ball. So many interesting things have gone on with Darden over the last couple of years. If you recall, Starboard Value came in and did a proxy contest and cleared out the whole board. which is not an easy thing to do. I've worked with Starboard in my former hedge fund life, and they're great guys, and they were really successful in this case. And Jeff Smith actually just resigned from the board. He was the chairman. He's the head of Starboard. He just said, okay, things are going well. I'm going to move on to other things. He just came off the board. They successfully spun off some real estate into a new public company. FCPT is the symbol. It's trading at $20 a share. That has a 4.8% yield. So if you look at the stock increase from Darden, about 35% over the last 2 years, and then you account for the fact that there's a whole new $20 per share company that also pays a nice dividend, Starboard has done a really good job here.
They have. I'm one question on the Capitol Grill, which you said
it is that, my favorite, actually.
You know, if you've been to if you like steak, you could do a whole lot worse than the Capitol Grill. In terms of footprint, they don't have that many of those. I mean, that is the highest end concept that they have under the Darden umbrella. It would seem like if they're looking to juice the returns, so to speak, opening a few more Capitol Grills would do the trick.
I think that's right, and I think a few more Capitol Grills is the right way to say it. I mean, it's a competitive space out there with Morton's and Ruth's Chris and some others. So you have to make sure you're in the right demographic, in the right area. The one or two that are around here are in relatively affluent areas. And so you just have to be careful that you put them in the right place.
It's a good company that's had a good run, obviously, as a stock. It hasn't had a down year since 2007, which is pretty good because a lot of companies had down year in 2008.
Yeah.
And it's not really done as well as the restaurant sector as a whole over longer periods of time. But as Ron points out, over the last couple of years, in response to some of the shareholder activism, it has turned around some of its cost structure. And I would expect them to continue to put an emphasis on that. Now, that's going to get a little harder with minimum wage seeping through into all aspects of the operations, but it puts a premium on, I think, companies that are already focusing on that and looking ahead. So that may be something that they can do more about than the competitors, but it's going to affect everybody.
Starboard value, it's a good point, Ron. They've had a really nice run recently. It really does seem like over the last few years, when Starboard gets involved in a hands-on way, shareholders end up doing pretty well as a result of that. It's almost like they're sort of collectively the opposite of Bill Ackman over the past few years.
Yeah, they're really smart guys. They're interested in owning stocks for relatively long periods of time. They're not looking to just make a quick profit and then get out, although they have sold a chunk of their Darden stake. But they're interested in going on boards and sticking around and helping companies improve their operations. And back in the days when I did transactions with them, we were looking at really small microcap stocks, and now they've really hit the ball out of the park, and they're looking at Yahoo's and Darden's and bigger companies, and they've done incredibly well.
Yahoo, God, you just reminded me that should be coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Yep.
with the final bids coming in. So we'll see where that shakes out as we gear up for the next round of earnings. At Market Foolery is our Twitter handle. Question from Lucas Coffey. Defensive stocks, and he cites ExxonMobil, 3M, GE, and Coca-Cola, are at or near all-time highs. Why is everyone so defensive? Is he onto something, or are those just four defensive stocks that happen to be doing well at the same time?
I don't know if they were chosen for that purpose. Of course, it is, as of right now, largely true that the stock market is not at, but near all-time highs. It's within, I don't know, 4%, 3%, yep, something like that. So some of these companies are within three. You know, if you're looking at a list of companies that are within 5% of their all-time highs, you've got a long list, some of which are defensive. And I think that the value has outdone growth in the recent past. So that is where some of the money is going as people pursue dividends, which are going to, in the companies that they think can maintain those dividends, that the low returns from bonds at this point compel yield seekers to look more and pay more for dividend stocks. And if they're offering something close to 3%, they're doing better than you're going to do with treasuries right now. So, you know, something like Exxon or GE, which are probably about as sound as the U.S. government, all things considered, and yet paying more, are going to be more attractive.
Yeah, and if 2015 was the year of FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and the like, I think you're seeing a more flight to, I don't want to use the word quality because those are quality companies, but less risky, more consistent, more stable companies, more value, less growth. And you tend to see that in uncertain times. People want more stability. They either sell their stocks or they move to stocks that are considered to be more stable. So I think we're seeing some of that.
Flight to stability?
That's, can I coin that?
Yeah, you can coin that. Yeah,
I mean, there's flight to yield, yeah. as there always is. People are always seeking a decent yield on their investment, and in the form of dividends. Whereas the S&P 500 as a whole is around to slightly over 2% yield, that's better than you're doing with 10-year treasuries. It's better than you're doing with a lot of things. And if you select, you know, something like an Exxon, which has got better yield than that, almost 3.5%, yeah, people are gonna pay up for that.
Let me go back to Hershey, just because as we've been talking, more details are starting to come out. And
this is a breaking news podcast.
This episode.
Do we do
first?
That?
This might be a first.
Check
yeah.
you out with your connectivity.
David Faber at CNBC, who's one of the people that I follow on Twitter, pointing out that the Mondelez bid is $107, 50-50 stock and cash, and that Mondelez has apparently offered to change the name of the company, the overall company, to Hershey, keep all manufacturing jobs in Pennsylvania, and move, and this goes back to what you were saying, Bill, and move global chocolate headquarters to Hershey, Pennsylvania. Boy, if you're a chocolate lover in Europe, that's going to terrify you.
Is it unsolicited, does it say? Or did these two guys get together for this?
He doesn't say, but my assumption is it was unsolicited. He also points out that in addition to winning over the Hershey Trust, Mondelez has to get approval from the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, which historically, much like the Hershey Trust, not necessarily open to greenlighting a lot of deals. So you have some experience with the Attorney General's office in Pennsylvania, don't you? Didn't you once upon a time?
I worked for the city of Philadelphia, which is slightly different, but the Attorney General of Pennsylvania is in such spectacular legal trouble already.
Why is that?
That's a long story that goes well outside of the parameters of this
business news.
And I don't want to start misrepresenting any part of the story. But she is no longer allowed to practice law. So
wait a minute. Hold on. She's still the Attorney General, but she's not allowed to practice law?
That is true, yes.
Actually, you know what? That doesn't surprise me, because here in Virginia, I remember reading about this years ago when we had a state election, and one of the offices you vote for is Attorney General. And I remember learning then that to be the Attorney General in Virginia, you don't have to be a lawyer.
So there's still hope.
There's still hope. Yeah. Do you want me to write you in the next
please,
time?
Please. I don't think you have to be in many legal jobs that you would consider that a prerequisite. But
Saul Goodman. Can I just write in Saul Goodman's name next time? Before we wrap up, Ron, I'm going to turn to you for your grilling expertise once more.
Because yes, sir.
I'm going to be doing some grilling this weekend. A lot of people are going to. It's a long weekend. Going to be doing some grilling. Is there a spice that you think is just overrated? Is there one where you're just like, I don't know why people talk about this? That thing is terrible.
Wow, a spice that is overrated. I think garlic powder is kind of cheesy. I think using fresh garlic is much better way to go. Sometimes it's easier, and it does make for a good rub, or at least part of a good rub.
You're a rub, not a marinade guy, right?
It depends what I'm doing. It depends on the quality of the cut, but they both work well.
So the higher the quality of the cut of meat,
the marinating is not as necessary.
Okay.
You can still impart flavor, but it's not as essential to the process.
Are you doing any grilling this weekend, Bill?
Well, I'll be up in upstate New York eventually once I get there. It's a pretty long drive. This is, we talked about my trip to Montreal, and this is where I'll be on the way up to Montreal. So with my family up there, and yeah, there'll be some grilling.
What are you grilling? Something specific? Or you don't know yet.
I don't know yet. Okay. I got to figure that out. But here's what I do know, and this is, we'll end on this note. As we wrap up this podcast, one floor above us, Lee Burbidge, one of our executives, heads up the people group, the people team here at Fool headquarters. Lee is grilling up some hot dogs for the company. So I think we just exit the studio and just head right upstairs to lunch.
Nice.
And so you brought up this overrated spices.
Yeah.
What have you got?
I didn't have any. That's why I turned to Ron. Ron's an expert.
It seemed like an odd question to me, but I thought you must have something.
Ron is
turmeric, perhaps
coriander. I just can't stand chervil.
No, Ron's a grill master, so I defer to him on all of those things. All right, Bill Barker, Ron Gross, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. That's going to do it for this edition of Market Foolery. The show is mixed by Dan Boyd. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Tuesday.